businesses. And as I mentioned earlier, too, universities are increasingly enlisted as a vector for real estate development. So building new campuses to anchor new creative or intellectual work zones or new sort of yuppie neo-suburbs in the middle of the city or what have you. There's a real struggle going on about the very soul of the university right now. And there's a lot of potential for that. But increasingly, the opportunities to think about a different sort of use or a different possibility for the university are being squeezed out.
And one example that I can draw on from UBC is we just constructed a massive new pharmaceutical research complex that was tremendously costly, but is built on this model where you build the top facilities and bring in the top researchers, and then the research that comes out of there provides money for patents, and then that helps to fund more and more university operations. And so if you look at the way the campus has developed over the last decade or so, anything that can generate patents has received new buildings on campus, and anything that is involved with the arts or humanities is basically in this increasingly older section of campus with more and more rundown buildings. And I know that's not just UBC example. There's many other institutions across North America that have followed the same model. But what is it that our universities should be teaching? You mentioned subjugated knowledges earlier in our interview. And so much of our vision about the future that's in mainstream society is kind of this Jetsons future where, you know, we have robots that take care of everything for us, and we have nutrition and our pills every day. Do you think we can have a university that exists without techno-optimism? And if that existed, what would it look like? What would it be teaching?
Yeah, that's a great point and a great question. You know, it's interesting that the idea of the university in the post-war moment was really tied to that sort of Jetsons future. The idea that, like, the promise was that if everyone worked hard and committed themselves to sort of enriching the capitalist system, that not only would the rewards of that system be more widely shared in the way that people would be allowed to have middle-class lifestyles, where they'd have their own home, their own appliances, etc., but that eventually we'd be working towards sort of the end of manual labor itself, that we would be liberated from work if we just trusted the captains of industry to sort of make the best use of our time and efforts. And of course, that never came to pass. So I think the university, at least in its sort of post-war appearance as a sort of popular mass university that enrolled a lot of students rather than just the sons and daughters of the elites, that's always had a sort of techno-utopian idea. And that techno-utopianism, as you guys have mentioned and illuminated on your show many times, is very much responsible for this idea that we don't actually need to solve the problems that are facing humanity and our societies and communities today. We can just wait for technology to fix the problem, which is crazy. So I think in terms of thinking beyond that model, I think we could imagine universities as a means by which we can bring our communities back together, relocalize a good deal of production, and really start to think about how to build a society that is in harmony or at least builds a new relationship with the earth and nature. I think we can definitely mobilize the university as a space to help us rethink what democracy would mean and what sort of solidarity would mean. And we can use it as a place to build up our capacity for empathy and working together. And I think those things are happening to a certain extent on all campuses. I think there are activist groups and activist professors and others who are trying to use the university as a space to do that. But we're facing a very, very large force, which is that the administrations that have been hired over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years really want the university to serve that corporate model. And increasingly, students who are going to the universities don't want it to be a space to think about alternatives, because I think they sense intuitively that that's a distraction from the cultivation of skills, knowledge, and competencies that they need to compete on the free market. Now, I've been a campus activist for a very long time, and what you often get from the vast majority of students is not just like I'm not interested, but almost like a paranoid fear of talking about these issues, or of talking about any issues that might interfere with their sort of consumption of an educational product. And that used to really bother me, and I used to get really angry with people for that attitude, but I've been thinking more and more recently that it sort of makes a perverse sort of sense. Because once you start thinking too deeply about these issues, it becomes very, very difficult to continue with that sort of competitive, accumulative mindset. Difficult, I should say, but the system also has a million ways of re-inscripting people, very critical people, back into its idiom of individualist competitiveness. So I've seen a lot of very excellent people who've thought very critically about these issues also get reinterpolated into the system over the years. just because it wears you down, and it wears you down with poverty, it wears you down with being alone, it wears you down with being sort of a lone voice. So I think if the universities have a function, it's to bring people together, to reassure them that, yes, they're not crazy, the system is fundamentally broken, and allowing us to think about and work together to build new ways out of it, new ways of building an alternative society from the ground up, from sort of within the crumbling ruins of our own society.
We were in Montreal over last summer at the Degrowth Conference that was being held at numerous universities in the city, and we got to take part and learn about the student movement there, and they were protesting against tuition increases. But then when you go and talk to people in the U.S. about it, either they didn't really hear about it at all, or the perception was, well, these are just whiny crybabies who have a minor tuition increase. Look at how much we pay for tuition, and it's way more than that. Then they were talking about free education, which is so opposed to anything that's going on in the U.S. and so opposed to most mindsets in the U.S. What do you think we've learned from the Montreal student movement, and can we expect to see some of these uprisings at universities or in cities around the world?
Yeah, it's funny that multiple generations of Quebec students have been fighting against tuition, the imposition of tuition fees, and then the hiking of tuition fees for a very long time. And it's been a really phenomenal struggle. And this last bout of struggle in 2012 was only sort of the latest step, a very dramatic step, but the latest step in that multi-generational struggle. I think what we can learn from it is a couple of things. The first is that that strike was built out of very serious grassroots organizing. It wasn't built out of student unions or established student organizations as much, although those organizations ended up playing an important role. It was people going to their colleagues and to fellow students and saying, look, here's the problem, we need to fight it, and really working one-on-one with students to build their consciousness of the problem and to build enough solidarity that they could sort of department by department vote to go on strike. So I think one of the first lessons is that real change and real social movements take time and energy and a lot of grunt work. It's not just about slogans and heading out to the streets, which is great. I love both those things. But it was a lot of work for the organizers involved. The other thing I think which is really interesting about that struggle, and the reason that they won, I think, is that they based their protest on principles rather than pragmatics. They started and ended with a very strong insistence that they were against the commercialization and commodification of education, and that the ultimate horizon of their struggle was free education. Not everyone in the struggle agreed with those principles, but a large number of people did. And I think what's happened, especially in student movements, but in social movements throughout North America recently, is that people have been tempted to give up on the principles of the struggle and just focus on what they think they can win, or focus on making a sort of palatable message for the general public. And I think what they did in Quebec is say, no, you know, we fundamentally believe university education should be free. And because we believe that, we are going to go on strike and we're not going to back down, even though the Quebec government passed an incredibly regressive law, which basically forbade street demonstrations. And in fact, because I think they stood on principle, when that law came down in May of last year, they were joined in the streets by trade unions, by everyday people banging pots and pans in the casserole demonstrations. Because I think what the public saw in that was not just a special interest group demanding their fair share. They saw young people fundamentally refusing a model of society that, again, almost everyone realizes is broken. So when they stood on principle, they in some way embodied the aspirations of a much larger group of people. Those are the two lessons that I really learned from the Montreal student strike. And it's a shame that it hasn't caught on as much in the United States, and also in the rest of Canada. I mean, the rest of Canada, people knew about it, but there certainly wasn't a huge amount of sympathy for it, for various historical reasons. So it would be great if people would look at that example, yeah.
So that was the extra environmentalist talking about education and our education system, which we thought was very apropos considering the coming up AMS elections that are going down. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. It was very interesting just sitting and listening to their opinions on the education system at the moment. and where we kind of go from here. So to lighten the mood up a little bit and hopefully bring some hope to us all, we're going to listen to a little bit of music. So first up, we have Postscript from their debut album, also called Postscript, and the song is called Grande Prairie. I'm very, very bad at French. I've taken it for so long and I still can't master the accent. Okay, here it is. Okay, so that was the beautiful Postscript, which was very lovely to listen to. I hope you all enjoyed that too. And now we have a quick advert.
Oh my, become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
The Baker and the Chef, Bangon T-Shirts, Cherry Bomb, House of Vintage, Beat Street Records, Downlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, His Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save on Meats, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you. That's what friends are for.
Okay, that's exactly where we are, as the advert said. This is CITR 101.9. live from the UBC campus here in Vancouver. And so next up, we have another very beautiful song. And this is from an artist called Sweet Alibi from their album We've Got To. And the song is called I'll Wait.
I've been sitting here by your side every day for a long time. I've been wondering who you could be, what you would see. I've been watching you every day.
come join the Musqueam Nation in support of fundraising for their youth cultural exchange to New Zealand. Headlining the fundraiser will be Murray Porter, a Juno Award-winning blues musician critically lauded for the interplay between his buttery soft keyboard skills and his gravelly intonated voice. The fundraiser benefits 7 Musqueam youth who will be traveling to Rotorua to explore Maori culture and how it can inform their own traditional experience. The event will be held at the Musqueam Cultural Center, located at 4000 Musqueam Avenue on Saturday, February 8th at 7 p.m.
Okay, so I couldn't resist playing another one of their songs because they are really, really great. So once again, that was Sweet Alibi. The album is We've Got To, but this song was called Never Change, which was lovely. And so now we're just going to have a little bit of a talk show. We thought in light of our last show and also as well as the AMS elections that have been going on this week, that it's the perfect time to kind of talk about our education system.
What is your education doing for you? But actually, though, when they were discussing everything about how we sort of go into the system, we pay all this money, and all we really want out of it is a job, and we get put through this meat grinder of a system, and we're not thinking enough about working together as a community to question the system that we're going through. And I thought it was appropriate with this election because, you know, I was reading an article in the Syrup Trap the other day about, it was a satirical article about people not even knowing that the AMS existed, which I'm sure is true for a lot of, if there's any first years listening, or maybe even second or third years.
Or even fourth.
Or even fourth years. But yeah, it's relevant and it's important to be involved in the system that you're being put through. So think about it. Maybe go onto the AMS website and vote.
Definitely. I was on the AMS website earlier, actually, sending some emails and this and that. But it's funny how we have this huge list of all these clubs, but how are we possibly meant to know which one is right for us? I mean, we have Club Stay at the beginning of the year in September, but then that's really our only big opportunity to get involved. And we're all running around like crazy chickens anyway, because there's so many things out there. How are we meant to know? How do we find what we want to do?
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is finding stuff that you actually want to do and not just stuff that you think is going to look good on your resume, because I think I am actually in my fifth year, so I am looking at what's going to help me get a job or get a career. But at the same time, it's discouraging and it's upsetting because I feel like there's so much pressure just to do something just because I might get a job out of it and not out of, you know, my own enjoyment, which is difficult. And I was just saying to Jenna earlier that on the topic of graduate studies, I've been looking on a lot of forums thinking about going to grad school, and it's a very depressing and discouraging place on the internet. It's basically a bunch of people telling you you're screwed and you're never going to get a job, so give up. So you have that to look forward to, fifth years and fourth years who are listening.
Do you think there's more pressure now to go to grad school, say, than maybe 20 years ago when it was seen, oh, wow, you have a degree, that's great. And now it almost seems like you have a degree, but are you at graduate school? Are you going to get a master's or anything like that?
Definitely. I think as an art student, I'm constantly being asked what I'm going to do with my degree. and my rebuttal is usually that I'm not going to do anything with it. It was just nice to have. I enjoyed my education. I enjoyed it because I like to learn. I like to learn, you know, I'm a nerd. And I think, like the program earlier was saying, there's not enough emphasis on education as something that makes you a better person and a better citizen. It's all about what you're going to do with your degree, which, you know, is kind of upsetting for me.
Just bringing up on the note when you mentioned arts, from being an international student and moving here from England, I find it really fascinating how there's this whole stigma around arts and what can you do with an arts degree that we just don't have in the UK at all. And it's really discouraging, like coming here and being told, well, you're in arts? Oh, like, good luck. You know,
basically,
you're probably not going to get a job. And it's, I don't understand it. It's something that's so, like, different in the UK. We don't have any kind of stigma. Why, where has this stigma come from and why do we have it here?
I think it's just not seen as practical. I think, you know, as I'm a history student, and so basically I'm constantly told, oh, like, so you're going to be a teacher, right? Or you're going to be a lawyer. And that's it, you know? There's nothing else beyond that. And yeah, I mean, I was never good at math and never good at science, so this is what I did and this is what I like to do, and it is really discouraging, and I'm so tired of people being like, you are a loser and you don't have any skills, which might be true, I don't know.
No.
Y'all don't know me, so maybe, but...
I can vouch that it isn't true.
Good, thank you. No, yeah, so I don't know if that's interesting that it's not like that in the UK. Mm. Because I know that they're having lots of problems with unemployment there as well as here and pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, I think unemployment definitely is on the rise in the UK, particularly amongst the youth. But there's, yet again, at university, it's there's no kind of distinction between, oh, you're in a B science or a B com or a BA. We just don't have that. No one even really acknowledges what kind of degree they're in. It's just seen as a degree like everyone else's, just a different specialization, rather than here, obviously, where we have this kind of exclusion of arts as we are the dumb people, and oh, you've got in on a lower average than us, and it's very, very strange, and it's taking a lot to get used to, and it does make you worry, though, like you said, that maybe our prospects are,
you know,
not great.
I'm gonna say that I actually think, I mean, I'm sure this has been argued a billion times, but It's harder to do well in arts because it's so subjective, and you really have to. It's a crapshoot at the end of the day. If your prof likes you, they'll be like, "You're brilliant," like your research is brilliant. And if they're just not into what you have to offer, then it might be, you know, the reverse. So I don't know. I mean, UBC, it's huge. The arts faculty is giant, and it gets a lot of a bad press, I'd say, some bad PR. But, you know, I'm biased as well, so I don't know what's going on in science and business and, you know, land and food systems.
And all these other things.
All these other things. But, yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to listen to a lovely song by Wet Denim. Their album is also called Wet Denim, a debut album. And the song is called My Guy, which hopefully will lift us up a little bit.
So Don't forget to vote in the upcoming AMS elections. The AMS is your student society. While there may be other elections happening in other constituencies during this time frame, the AMS elections affect all UBC students. The voting period is from January 27th to the 31st. For information on candidates and how to vote, go to ams.ubc.com.
So that was a little plug for the AMS elections, which is what we were just talking about, actually. Yeah. We were talking about school and getting educated.
Getting that education.
What does it all mean, you know? yeah, just practicing my, like, sexy radio voice, which isn't actually working out so well for me, I don't think.
Sounds pretty good for you.
Cool. I'm glad to hear. Yeah, so you are in your first year, right, Jen?
Yes. Yes. First year.
So how would you say the AMS has done with sort of like letting you in on the elections? Because I know in my first 2 years, I did not vote and had no idea what the hell was going on. I'll admit to that on the public radio.
You're going down with that now.
Yeah, I know. I was going to take it to my grave, but I just couldn't live. Couldn't live with the secret. Yeah, so what, like, do you feel like you're being educated on your rights?
I really want to highly commend, I'm not sure if anyone from Divest is listening, but Divest have been outside canvassing every day, and I've been certainly very close to going and buying them coffee and talking to them, and I nearly did earlier, but then they were talking to people and they were a bit busy. But I really feel like they've put themselves out there and are really making an effort to educate people. They had these random chants the other day by the fountain, and it's so nice to see a student group going out and really fighting for something that they believe in. And I have to say that's the only group that I have seen out, like, actively campaigning in this election. I haven't really come across any of the candidates. I haven't heard much apart from Divest, which I really agree with and I think are awesome. So I definitely am 100% voting yes to Divest. But everything else, I still feel like I'm in a bit of a blur with, especially this joke candidate thing. I don't really understand the whole joke. I find it funny that there's a joke candidate. I just didn't understand what that meant. So I think that's really interesting. I definitely like a lot of what the joke candidates have done. Yeah, again, I've only really seen what they've done. I haven't heard much about the real deal. But I am definitely voting, and I have encouraged all my friends to vote too. And although it is going to take me a while to sit and read through everything and make a educated decision, I think it's important. I think this is my student society, and I need to stand up and say something.
Good for you, man. You're doing better than I was doing. just a cog in the wheel I was.
So why didn't you vote in the first couple of years?
I think I just didn't know enough about the candidates, and I don't know, like, I'm really bad with voting. Like, I feel like I should be doing my research. Like, even my, like, voting in, like, municipal elections, I'm really bad. I'll always just, like, vote for the person that I think is the underdog. That's usually my go-to. I'll be like, this guy.
He ain't gonna get no other votes.
No one's gonna vote for him, so I will. But, yeah, I mean, I definitely got more into it. I actually knew someone personally who was running, and that's what got me into it, because I was like, this person's great. They actually didn't win, but you know, but you know, I think sometimes it's those personal connections that get you motivated when you actually are able to see who the candidates are and what they really are striving to do.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, now I'm like old, and I just like, I don't care what happens to the school once I'm out of it. Is that terrible? I'm saying really incriminating things right now on the radio. It's really bad. But no, it's not that I don't care. It's just like, you know, it's like the building of the sub. Like, they built it. I'm not even going to get to see it.
Yeah, could do a sixth year.
Maybe I'll do a sixth year. Just take it. Drag it out. Take it slow, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe take 30 extra credits, because why not? Like, I do like to learn. I said that earlier.
And it's not very expensive at all.
Yeah,
that is
totally
a joke. No one likes student fees. I think I agree with you about the personal thing, and we find it quite hard to be personal with other people here because there's so many people. And again, being a commuter school makes it even harder because people are living all over the city and not within easy reach of each other. It is definitely hard to kind of find a personal connection with these people or like understand or know of them or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone knows that UBC has that problem of being this very sort of despondent and spread out kind of community. So you have to look for those groups and those clubs and those ways to meet people and find out. Which, speaking of which, like yesterday, I was sitting in the studio with the UBC Brew.
Oh.
And their referendum is on the vote on the
yes.
ballot. So
everyone
you should vote yes so that UBC can get a microbrewery. Because I think what really brings people together is the consumption of alcohol. And I have always found that that is the greatest social lubricant for myself.
This is great.
But really, like, I'm just exposing my terrible personality to the world or whoever's listening to CITR right now, which I like to think is
everyone.
The world. Yes. I just realized that I forgot to ID that last track that we played. That was Sunshine off of their album Sunshine, and the song was called Sundays Are for Cats, which is a great title. Great title for a song.
When you started with the S there, I thought the song was going to be called Sunshine too.
Yeah, and then the song is also they're not a creative band. No, I'm just kidding. They're great.
No musical talent whatsoever.
No. Yeah.
And that is why we listen to it.
That's what we're all about at CITR. No musical talent. This is going downhill pretty quickly. So
anything that is good, not allowed. So, all about the underdog.
Yeah, that's right. We should all start supporting really shitty bands because I think, you know, they need our support.
Yeah, so we could start our own band too.
Yeah, maybe we'll start a show that's just only bad music.
Like really bad.
I would listen to that show.
Would you?
I think I would. It's interesting. It's like watching bad movies. I love watching bad
movies. Oh, that is true. And then you watch them again and again and you can't resist and you go back and 10 times later and you're like, oh, damn it.
If you've ever seen The Room... People out there that have seen The Room, you know what I'm talking about. It's the worst movie ever made, but it's also the best movie ever made for that reason. It's, check it out. If you've never seen it before. Or just like take a cult film studies course and you'll probably get to watch it. And it's very, very cool. So why don't we stop talking? Because I feel like maybe people are getting tired of the sound of my voice and all the terrible things that I've been saying, right? So we'll get back to some music. So we're going to hear from This Is The Shoes, their album Bust. Yes. I actually was reading about them on the Discorder website, which is why I thought, why not play some? They've got a really cool sound. They're like very bluesy, which I love, but a little different. And I think there's some harmonica involved, which is always good. So here we go. This is The Shoes.
Thank you. say, but as long as you are with me, there's no place I'd rather be.
You are listening to The Terry Project.
Terry Project.
The Terry Project.
Terry Project Podcast.
From CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM.
Here at UBC.
The University of British Columbia.
In Vancouver.
To find out more.
Even more.
About The Terry Project, visit our website at
terry.ubc.ca.
And subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
My one big idea
is priceless.
What can be better than that?
So, we are back, and we just heard the song Backwards from This Is the Shoes off their album Bust, and then we heard from a band called Clean Bandit, and the song was called Rather Be, featuring Jess Glynn. You said there's good house remixes of that.
Yeah, right? Definitely. Anyone who's into that. Deep house, there's some really nice mixes of that, which is super relaxing, which is why we put it on.
Very cool. All right, so next up, you're going to have our regular 4 p.m. slot, Aboriginal show.
Which is very, very awesome for any of you that have heard it before. I'm sure you're all starting to switch on now in preparation.
All right. So we will
be signing off.
Signing off, indeed.
So you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Jenna.
This is Julia. Have an excellent day.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
You are listening to The Terry Project.
Terry Project.
The Terry Project.
Terry Project Podcast.
From CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM.
Here at UBC.
The University of British Columbia.
In Vancouver.
To find out more.
Even more.
About The Terry Project, visit our website at
terry.ubc.ca.
And subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
My one big idea
is priceless.
What can be better than that?
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Studying abroad looks great on your resume and opens doors for exciting career paths. Don't miss the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Wednesday, February 26th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Convention Center, East Ballroom. Admission is free. Come early at 2 p.m. to listen to our guest seminar on how to access over $100 million worth of scholarships for your studies. Check the website on studyandgoabroad.com.
Don't forget to vote in the upcoming AMS elections. The AMS is your student society. While there may be other elections happening in other constituencies during this time frame, the AMS elections affect all UBC students. The voting period is from January 27th to the 31st. For information on candidates and how to vote, go to ams.ubc.com.
Wow, so smooth. Such art must have. It's the
new format of Discord. Join us at the Astoria on Friday, January 31st, as that magazine from CITR celebrates the launch of a brand new redesign with some great local bands, including Cult Babies, Catlow, War Baby, Hallow Moon, and more.
Yeah, well.